You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Love is...
Exhilarating and exciting.
Love is...
keeping things spicy.
Love is...
Hot. So hot.
Wait. Are you eating a Penn Station Buffalo Chicken Sub?
Well, yeah. It's only here for a limited time. I love you.
Huh. Now that's a sub I can love.
Spice things up with our Buffalo Chicken Sub. Available for a limited time. Penn Station. Love your sub.
Hello and welcome to another episode of All My Best Friends Are Digital. I'm Caitlin Bailey, one of your hosts, and I have with me my co-host, Mark Bigney. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm very well, Caitlin. How are you?
I am alive.
I thought we weren't going to be talking about politics, Caitlin.
I'm not the one that brought it up. I'm just slowly suffering.
I don't know. Here you are flaunting your biological state. That sounds like some sort of weird woo-woo politics talk to me.
Today, we're going to be discussing what we're currently playing.
I should be on a podcast. I'm alive. We only believe in merit here, and All My Best Friends Are Digital.
Yes, that's all. Then we're going to talk about Castlevania, Aria of Sorrow for the GBA in our retro game segment, Goof, followed by Dragon's Dogma 2, our feature title. And then finally, Mark will shout out something he's looking forward to, because I am not looking forward to anything anymore.
Grim.
So Mark, what are you playing lately?
Okay, I would like to make a semi-shameful admission. I would like to issue a hot take and solicit your opinion on that hot take, and then I will talk more about the other game that I've been playing this week. So the connective tissue will make sense in a moment. I actually reinstalled and played a little bit of Dead or Alive 6. Now, I will defend some aspects of Dead or Alive, not all aspects of Dead or Alive. I don't think anyone could, with a straight face and good faith, do so. Dead or Alive is a fighting game series infamous for its great enthusiasm for something in particular. And let's just put it all on the table. They love ninjas. They love big ninjas. They love animating ninjas. They like putting ninjas in lots of different costumes. It's all about a lot of ninjas in motion.
Right.
So much motion for all of the ninjas. Yeah. Here's the thing, though. I will defend the fact that the Dead or Alive fighting system, for a long time, ever since Dead or Alive 2, I think, has been super solid. I'm not particularly sympathetic to board games or a lot of other games that seek to elaborate on rock, paper, scissors. There are some versions that I think it works. But in the context of action games, or fighting games in particular, rock, paper, scissors can be the basis for a very good system. And the fundamental hold, throw, blow system in Dead or Alive makes it in a very, very accessible way. You know, the idea of a counter move not being unique to only some characters and based on a very, very obscure series of button presses was somewhat revolutionary for the time, and I think it still holds up real, real well. That having been said, it is still fundamentally embarrassing, even though in Dead or Alive 6, they infamously tried to make a shift towards a more respectable esports kind of veneer. First of all, you ain't never going to be anything other than Dead or Alive. Don't stop trying to pretend to be anything other. And here's where I get to my hot take, though. I understand entirely, and I'm completely on board with everyone talking about how Dead or Alive is juvenile and definitely catering to a particular subset of a video game audience. The thing is, I think it serves as a kind of a lightning rod, though. Kind of a sandbag, kind of a convenient straw man. Because, and I mean this very seriously, if you look at fighting games as a whole, they are closer to Dead or Alive than they would like to admit. So for Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat and Tekken and all these other series to look down their nose like, oh, you play Dead or Alive. Oh, Dead or Alive is all about boobs. I'm sorry. You cannot show me the character designs of other fighting games and tell me that Dead or Alive is the one that over-sexualizes its cast. It definitely isn't more than the other ones. No question about that entirely. I'm not going to claim otherwise.
Yeah.
But the idea that Dead or Alive is the embarrassing one, but Street Fighter and Tekken and all the other ones get to be okay, that has always struck me as facially ridiculous. Am I alone in this, Caitlin?
I don't know. I mean, I can see Dead or Alive has really played up its ninja physics a lot over the years. But yeah, I mean, I can't say that they are, I mean, they are worse probably in the terms of ninjas, but yeah, everyone else does it. No one has a high horse to be sitting on. Let's put it that way. If anything, they have maybe a tiny little pony.
Thanks for bringing it back to some of our core foci here. Yes. At All My Best Friends Are Digital. I sincerely appreciate that. Which causes me to talk a little bit more about the recent release I've been playing a lot more of, and that is Virtua Fighter 5 Revo. Because in this universe of deeply embarrassing representations of women, I think that Virtua Fighter earns, let's say, a bronze star for being better than I think almost all the rest of them. It's not really a mainstream series. It's not going to be like the main stage of Evo. But in terms of like a lot of the classic long-running series, I mm-hmm. genuinely think it's probably the best. I won't defend everything that it does, but it is, in terms of its costume design, in terms of its character design, in terms of what it chooses to animate and how, I do think that it is the fighting game series that you can show your mother for what it's worth. And yeah. Also play without feeling too embarrassed as a feminist or indeed as a decent human being. But then again, I repeat myself. Anyway, Virtua Fighter 5 Revo, I don't know what Revo stands for, but it's an acronym, is the latest release for modern consoles and for PC. It's mostly just Virtua Fighter 5 with the latest balanced patches and a fresh coat of paint. And I am a huge Virtua Fighter fan. I have been ever since the beginning, but the ones that I played the most of were definitely 1, 4, and now 5.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, the only access I'd had to Virtua Fighter 5 was on the PS5, and I'm not a huge fan of the PS5, frankly, and I found the load times really bad. I don't know. It's weird. I have a love-hate relationship with the PS5, where mostly I love to hate it, but it's irrational. I'm not going to defend that. And so now that it's available on Steam, I have been playing the crap out of Virtua Fighter 5 Revo. So one thing that I reminded that I wish other fighting games did was that Tekken does this thing that I think every fighting game especially and every video game series should do in general. In a perfect world, Caitlin, I come from Montreal, I come from French Canada. In a perfect world, everyone would just speak their native language and we would just understand each other well enough to get by. Very frequently in French Canada, what you have is the worst case scenario where the Francophone is speaking English and the Anglophone is speaking French. And so naturally you understand and are understood as little as possible. But in a universe where everyone just speaks their native language, it works. And Tekken has been doing that for years. And I think that's the way that things ought to be. You have a Korean cast member who's about to fight a French cast member. Well, the Korean's going to speak Korean and the person from France is going to speak French. And that's fine. Just subtitle it and it's fine and it's great.
That's actually something that I liked a lot that Overwatch did.
Oh, that's great. I had no idea.
Yeah.
More games should do this. Instead, what you have frequently for Japanese game development is you end up in this absurd context where they basically have decided that everyone is going to speak one of two languages, Japanese or English, and then they get to decide whether the language in question is closer to Japanese or closer to English. Which mostly just parses out into Asian versus non-Asian. But then they sometimes pull some weird stuff with people from like Thailand or Malaysia or other parts of this. Anyway, it's bizarre and I do not approve of it. On top of that, the voice work in Virtua Fighter 5, especially for the English cast, is embarrassingly obnoxious.
Like, oh no.
Jackie and especially my main, Leon Rafal, they sound so nasal and whiny. It's terrible. Anyway. The fighting system in Virtua Fighter 5 is brilliant. It absolutely has. The reason why I analogize it to Dead or Alive is primarily because it seems to work on like the basic lattice work of a sort of a rock, paper, scissors mechanism is absolutely in work in the case of Virtua Fighter 5, except they don't really work on holds or counters very much. Instead, it's about dodges and evasions. And I remember back when I was at my peak in Virtua Fighter 4, which is to say when I was still pretty terrible, and, you know, you'd launch a combo string, and before your combo string was done, you'd already input the command to evade in case they counterattacked when it was their turn. And at the same time, you cached the throw evasion in with the dodge. And then whether or not they countered any of that, you were already ready, like, three steps ahead. It was one of those things where your entire concentration was marshaled in what was going on, and you're just in that pocket. I haven't been in that kind of state for decades, but I remember what it was like to be knee deep in Virtua Fighter. And it's been nice to go back to the Virtua Fighter systems, and I really appreciate what they've done with it graphically. I think it does look a lot better than it used to. It still sounds terrible, but that's a minor thing. There's going to be a Virtua Fighter 6. One can hope that they will try to... I mean, people have been complaining about Leon's voice for years now. I mean, nobody likes the way he sounds. He sounds awful. Most people find him obnoxious generally, and that's fair. He's an obnoxious character, but there's stuff that can be done. At any rate, it has a reputation for being one of the most difficult fighting games to play. That, I think, is fair and not fair at the same time. I think, actually, it's pretty accessible. It's not as accessible as something like Tekken, but the combo system, for one thing, is easier. It also looks less silly. Like, you can have a visual sense. One of the reasons why I don't really like the modern Tekkens, ever since Tekken 6 mostly, is that the game is dominated by these very, very long combo strings where you're just constantly hitting someone as they're shuffling along the ground, and you're doing these high attacks that somehow manage to hit them even though their body has already bounced off the ground. It's visually discordant, and I find it counterintuitive. Comboing in Virtua Fighter makes perfect sense to me. If I think something is apt to hit, it's likely to hit. If I think it's going to be too high, it's probably going to be too high. And in that sense, I find it vastly more approachable. And so you're not memorizing as many combo strings, and so you can focus a little bit more on the cat and mouse of the rock, paper, scissors mechanism. Now, the skill ceiling in Virtua Fighter is real high.
Yeah. Like,
there are people... I find it deeply unfortunate that Akira, A, looks entirely exactly like a Ryu, and B, is the character that the character select icon starts on, thereby leading people to believe that he might be sort of a default entry character. This is a lie. This is a grotesque lie. It is one of the most misleading things in the history of video games. His moves are devastatingly effective, but they rely on, like, one-frame links all the time, and they're just incredibly hard to pull off. Anyway, so if you're considering trying Virtua Fighter but have been intimidated, I encourage you to give it a shot. It's really good, and you can just wail on some buttons and get start with Jackie, start with his sister. They're fine. You can do attack strings no problem with them, and you'll be able to get through and do some stuff. Just don't start with Akira unless you're a serious, serious masochist. Anyway, I adore Virtua Fighter. It's been one of my favorite fighting game series. And that is what I have been up to lately. What's your history with Virtua Fighter, Caitlin?
I think the only Virtua Fighter game that I've ever played is 4. When I was... At one time, I was the president of the University of Massachusetts Video Game Club. And one of the main things that we did is we played fighting games. And it was... I mean, it was right around when I think Virtua Fighter 4 had come out. There was probably a new Tekken... There's a lot of Super Smash Brothers, I think Melee going on. It was a really fun time. But I played a bunch of Virtua Fighter 4 and Tekken. I wasn't a big fan of Tekken, but I assume it's me. I have a tough time like learning like a lot of combos and stuff. I don't know. I don't play enough of one fighting game to get super, super comfortable. Oh, and of course we played tons of Soul Calibur. I was a Soul Calibur girl, so I played a lot of Soul Calibur 2. I really liked the shield. What were their names? Sophitia and Sophitia. Something. Yes. And I forget her sister's name, but I played both of them a lot, and I played Talim as well.
I find it interesting that you were heavy into fighting games during the dark ages of fighting games, just as the arcades were in their death throes, just before the genre was kind of sort of brought back from the dead by Street Fighter 4.
Yeah, we had the video game club was made up of a lot of fighting game fans, connoisseurs. So I think that is part of what kind of drove us to fighting games every Thursday night or whatever it was when we played.
So what have you been up to, Caitlin?
All right. So I have I started playing Void Crew. Void Crew was released late last year, and it's a sci-fi co-op roguelite, and it can be played with up to 4 people. Apparently there's mods where you can play with more people, but I haven't tried one of those yet. So I've only played in full 4-player games, so I have no idea what it's like with fewer people, but I would guess it's quite difficult. I don't know if it would be fun with a small group. But anyway, you play as an Ektype, which is like some kind of clone warrior, and you can choose your specialty from 4 options. So you can be a pilot, an engineer, a gunner, or a scavenger. Each one of those options gives you a special ability that makes you a little bit better at that task. So like, in general, like pilots are going to be piloting the ship. Engineers are going to be making repairs and improvements to the ship. Gunners predictably shoot things. And scavengers are good at collecting stuff off ship. So I've only played as a scavenger so far. Their special ability is like this grappling hook thing. So you can grapple onto something far away and zoom toward it, and it's awesome. And yeah, I don't know. It's been really fun. Each run is, I forget exactly how many stages there are. There's maybe 6, but you choose what kind of mission you're going to go do. And there's a variety of different mission types. And generally, you're given an option between a normal difficulty, hard difficulty, and insane difficulty. And based on that, you get different rewards and experience. And after, I think, the 2nd or 3rd part of the run, you're able to early exit. And if you early exit, you get a little bit more stuff than you would if you died horribly. Yeah, it's been very fun. We have not yet finished a run. We haven't even attempted a boss because the difficulty tends to ramp up enough toward the end that we're not comfortable attempting a boss. But it's been very fun to learn all together, because all five of us, because I've played with a mix of different people, are complete noobs, had no idea what was going on, learning stuff as we go along, and it's been very enjoyable to do that.
I have seen you through my Steam notifications playing Void Crew, and I was very much hoping that you were going to be talking about it, because I have a number of questions. Because yes. I purchased Void Crew, and then I returned it. Because I played the tutorial, and I found it, number 1, super jank. Because sometimes indie games feel just like AAA games in terms of menu design and controls. I had to fiddle with a number of settings to get Void Crew to work in the first place. Because the sensitivity was all off. The motion tracking was weird. I had a devil of a time getting it to show up properly on my monitor. Just a whole bunch of weird things, rough edges that I'm not accustomed to anymore. That I can navigate and did, but definitely didn't instill confidence in the quality of the final product. And then I did the tutorial, which I realize is something you probably haven't touched.
I was required to do it, in fact. I could not skip it, so.
Okay. Yeah. It just didn't seem like the kind of thing where I wanted to invest the social capital necessary to get a whole bunch of my friends to buy the game, especially since, you know, we already have Helldivers 2. And look, part of it, I will confess, I saved this for the last because it might be the most determinative. I have been looking for something that is like FTL. Ever since playing FTL.
Okay.
And multiplayer FTL would make me so happy. We played a little bit of This Means Warp. And This Means Warp was just very, very, very simple. It was a little overly simplistic for our tastes. And so I was hopeful the Void Crew would be something like that. But Void Crew struck me as, again, a little bit too janky and a little bit yet more complex in terms of ship management and stuff. So I'm very glad to hear that you've been enjoying it. Maybe I should try it again.
Yeah, so for what it's worth, I can make no comparisons to FTL because I have not played it.
Oh my goodness, Caitlin.
I know.
FTL is so good.
I am pretty sure I technically own it. But yeah, I haven't played it. I believe, who was it? I think my husband did compare it to FTL, but I don't know how much FTL he has played either. But yeah, so as far as jank, I can't say that I experienced too much. I think I hit 1, quote, game-breaking bug, but it was, my internet was failing at the time, so I think a bunch of things went wrong.
I had some pretty catastrophic failures of physics. I had some object clipping and some things were operating weirdly as well.
Okay. Yeah. I haven't seen any of that. The only thing that has been funny is our mutual friend, Chris, the one that isn't my husband. Every time he would sit down in a chair, his character would end up sitting like 3 feet away from the chair. And that was like the biggest jank thing. And like, really didn't like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't affect anything.
Well, that just shows how simulationist the game is. It managed to capture the essence of, I mean, everyone calls him No Chair Chris.
Yes, of course. But yeah. Oh, and the meta progression is actually pretty fun. The one thing that I'm not sure of with Void Crew is once you do fully level up, is it still fun to play? I don't know. I am level 10, I think, and I believe that there's 30 levels. And as you level up, you get talent points, which is like the main meta progression, because you can put talent points into your character to improve, you know, their whatever specialty you pick. I think, I'm pretty sure you can also put talent points into the other trees as well. You just can't get their special ability, but you can pick up some of like the, you know, the sub abilities.
That reminds me of another criticism I heard that sounded plausible based on my very, very limited experiences with Void Crew, which was, are the specialisms empowering or limiting? Like, if you are the scavenger, if you got a full crew and you've got a gunner, a scavenger, a pilot, and an engineer, does that just mean that that's the one thing you'll be doing and that doesn't make a whole lot of sense for you to be doing anything else? Or is it just that you're better at it? Like, are you ever in a game of Void Crew forced to do all of the things in Extremis? Or is it just, you, Caitlin, will be scavenging, get out the ship, we'll see you in a few years?
I would say, so for the most part, the pilot, mostly the pilot just moves the ship around. Every now and then he has, you know, gotten up from the pilot seat and gone on a mission with me and everybody else. Like every now and then, all of us will just leave the ship at the same time because it's still, you still can only hold one thing. So if there's four items that are in this, you know, derelict ship that you're checking out, it's better if four people just go grab them and then you go back to the ship. The gunner would spend most of the time sitting, you know, gunning. But for myself as scavenger, there's some missions where there's no reason to get off the ship. So I usually end up being like kind of a second gunner or a second engineer, like basically just trying to fill whatever we need to fill at the time. And the engineer also, honestly, was kept pretty busy with running around and dealing with stuff. So I would say that scavenger is the most flexible, but everybody can do everything.
So I confess, though, this is mostly a conceptual question, but again, it's partially informed by a few minutes of the game. It doesn't sound like it's very fun to be a pilot or a gunner in Void Crew, then. If you just sit in the chair and you just stay in the chair the entire mission.
Yeah, I think, I mean, so I can't speak for the gunners or the pilot that I've played with, because I have not done either of those jobs, but when speaking to them between missions to say, hey, do we want to switch things up? They're like, eh, it's fine. Like, I'm happy doing this. So okay. I think that each of those jobs has enough to keep them busy and having fun, regardless of what else is going on. But you're not sitting there not doing anything. Let's put it that way.
Have you ever played, this is an almost entirely different game from Void Crew. Have you ever played Artemis, the Starship Bridge Simulator?
Yes. Yeah, it's been a long time, but I did play that.
Did we ever play together? I used to have Artemis parties back in the day. I haven't had for a very, very long time. On the topic of janky multi-role science fiction space simulators. Because Artemis is a marvelous experience, but oh my goodness, are the system faults ever present.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure that Artemis came out after I had already moved to California. So I did play with a group, but I don't think I ever got the opportunity to play with you.
Okay.
But I believe my husband did drive us into a mine and kill us once, and that was pretty fun.
For those uninitiated, Artemis works. It's a fascinating perspective in the game design because it works because the interface is bad. If the interface were good, Artemis would be a one-player game that would be utterly unremarkable. But the interface is deliberately bad in such a way that it produces an engaging multi-person game. It's wild. the best way to express how this works is there is a captain. The captain has the best access to the best information in the entire game. They are able to see from a bird's eye perspective, figuratively speaking, how all the systems are working and what's on the map and what their challenges are and what the priorities need to be. The captain does not get to interface with any controls in the game whatsoever. If the captain wants a different view on the view screen, the captain has to ask someone to do it for them. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't play a lot of Artemis, but I had a really good time the couple sessions that I did do.
I've been also looking, in addition to looking for a multiplayer FTL, I've been looking for a more stable, more user-friendly equivalent to Artemis. There have been a couple, but I've never really been in the chance to try them. I mean, Quintet was sometimes bandied about. I should go looking into this. I've been threatening to have an Artemis party for a while. Maybe I should just do that and live with the fact that something like half the time you cannot play a mission to completion because one console drops out of the local area network and then it's all done for.
Yeah, I know that I played a VR. This was a mistake, by the way. I can't do VR, but I played a VR game within the last couple of years. It might have been Star Trek flavored. I'm not sure.
People rave about the Star Trek VR game, yeah.
Okay, I think that's the one that we played. Again, didn't really work for me because I get very motion sick. I mean, that one I remember being fun. Again, don't want to barf, so didn't do it.
Priorities.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for telling me about Void Crew. You've definitely given me something to think about. And we now move on to gaming opinions on old school funware, aka Goof. We're going to be talking about Castlevania Area of Sorrow. This is the third of the Castlevania games that was released on the Game Boy Advance. It was released by Konami in 2003. And my understanding is, Caitlin, that this is your first Castlevania.
Yes. If I played a Castlevania game before this one, I don't know what it would have been. And I certainly didn't play for very long. So, yeah, this is my first.
I have a very specific question for you, though, before you get into more your general reflections.
Okay.
Did you know to hit all the light sources?
I figured that out about halfway through my first play session, because I happened to attack when I went by it. And I was like, oh, okay.
I was curious because I knew that you were supposed to hit torches long before I ever played my first Castlevania game, and so I didn't know to what extent it would filter through to modern gamer consciousness, even independently of such things. Okay. Yeah. So what did you think about Area of Sorrow then?
So I don't know what I expected going into it, at least story-wise, because it's like, oh, yeah, it's some dude, and he's walking through a temple, I guess, with some girl. And then all of a sudden, we're at Dracula's castle. Okay.
it's pretty super dumb, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, oh, okay, sure,
I'm why just not? Some random student who, by the way, wears a long white trench coat and has silver hair, chilling out with his childhood friend. By the way, you can't be both born overseas and live overseas for most of your life and be childhood friends with a Japanese shrine maiden. I'm sorry, guys. You're loading too much in. And it's 2035 for some reason. Yeah. And, oh, man, it's a trip.
Yeah. That was a bit silly. but once Castlevania Aria of Sorrow gets going, I was having a lot of fun. I mean, there's a little bit of a gotta catch them all vibe because you have to defeat enemies until you capture their soul, which gives you some kind of ability or passive, which I admit I did not experiment with that, with those different ones probably as much as I should have, but there were so many.
Yeah.
So many.
And a lot of them are kind of garbage.
It is a little bit like...
I played Aria of Sorrow when it was first released for the Game Boy Advance, and coming back to it, I was like, is it really the case that the overwhelming majority of the souls you pick up are kind of garbage? Oh yeah, they're just bad. I don't switch them very much every once in a while. I find I stuck with the axe for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And even then I would have been happy with the spear that you start with because it's just vastly better than most things.
I know. I've been mostly sticking to the bone spear just because, I don't know, you can throw it and sometimes it even hits bosses multiple times. It's hard to argue with that. I tried out the skeleton archer where it, like, spawns an arrow, and then a single arrow just moves forward, and I'm like, I could have just used a bone spear, and that would have been better.
Yes, this is the tactical soul system. I think comparing it to Pokemon is perhaps appropriate, although it's a lot less cute in nature. I really like the enemies in Castlevania Era of Sorrow. I mean, visually, I think, generally, it's pretty good. The Game Boy Advance is my friend TechDweeb's favorite system because it was like the last mainstream system to use pixel graphics. And so they were at their apex of game design knowledge at the same time as being limited to the pixel graphics system. I, of course, point out that the Neo Geo was largely in the same situation, but whatever, who am I to point these things out? And I just really like how they really went to town on a lot of visual elements for no freaking reason. Like, there's an enemy that might appear in a single room, and it's lavished with so many frames of animation for no reason whatsoever, just because they wanted to.
Like, yeah.
The Minotaurs that you fight, they have these giant axes. If you kill them, their bodies get swathed in flames and they sink into the ground. But their giant axe, for no earthly reason, just goes flying up into the air and embeds itself in the ground afterwards. Just all these lovely visual touches that I very much appreciate.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous game. I really enjoyed that, you know, generally all the enemies have pretty good telegraphs for what they're going to do. And if you learn how to avoid those attacks, you can avoid taking damage. I was generally quite bad at it, but I think with practice, I could have gotten much better. That, yeah, like there, I mean, there was this one, I guess, suit of armor guy who could either throw an axe at standing height or, you know, kneeling height. And you can, you have to either jump or duck. And that was just one of the most obvious examples in the time that I played, but
it doesn't even fall prey to a lot of the standard Castlevania nonsense. Like, I've talked about this before. This is particularly bad in Rondo of Blood, which is widely regarded as one of the best Castlevania games. You're in this situation where something is flying through the air. It could be a bird, could be a bat. It's very often a bat. It could be a Medusa head. It could be a ghost, whatever. And you're doing a platforming section. And if you're if you miss time to jump, if you haven't killed them, you can just stand there and kill them all day long. The enemies will just keep coming. Okay, fine. So if you're, all right, I'll take the jump. And then you get hit at the very height of your jump, and the stun animation carries you all the way to the beginning of the platforming section. You just repeat this over and over and over again. Here, because, in part, I think because Aria of Sorrow has got kind of action RPG trappings, they've made it so that very low level enemies will just do 1 point of damage, and will they'll stun lock you, but they won't send you flying. They'll cause you to kind of stop in your tracks. And consequently, bats are no more deadly than bats might be in real life, rabies notwithstanding. I was attacked by a bat once. It's very traumatic. Moving on.
Yes.
And I had forgotten that in Area of Sorrow, they definitely toned down that level of stunlock nonsense.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised the first time that something hit me, because I was like, oh my god, this little baby enemy just... And I was like, oh, one hit point. Okay. All right, that's fine.
Yeah.
Great.
Now, the bigger thing is we'll take vastly larger quantities of hit points away from you, but
yes,
they don't flood the scene with a whole bunch of tiny things that end up being vastly more deadly than the large things that look more deadly. This I'd actually like to point out that there's a reprise called Area of Sorrow Reprise, which is a fan hack of Castlevania Era of Sorrow, which turns it into a roguelite structure where there's these randomized rooms and different ones, and you acquire special powers and stuff like that. It's really good, except I can't really play it because that's the one thing that they re-import from old Castlevania games. The same dynamic of tons of, in this case it's ghosts, tons of ghosts flying across the screen, and you just have to, they can't jump to the next platform because a stupid ghost hits you and then you're sent flying. Other than that, it's really cool. If you're at all inclined towards giving ROM hacks a try, I recommend Aria of Sorrow Reprise, but other than that, it's great.
Oh, no. The one flaw.
Well, it's just Mega Man does this too. It's a certain thing that action platformers do, and I find it supremely obnoxious. And I really respect the fact that Castlevania Era of Sorrow, for a variety of reasons, either consciously or by accident, just doesn't engage in that stuff. I don't remember if the other two GBA games from the Castlevania series, namely Circle of the Moon and Harmony of Dissonance, I remember them being good, not as good, but I don't remember if they pull that nonsense. There's also a sequel to Aria of Sorrow, which I don't remember, but I probably ended up playing. It's on the DS.
On the DS, okay.
Yeah, because that character, that silver-haired character with the weird coat, was just so compelling they had to bring him back.
Yeah. When I first saw him, I was like, wait, are you trying to tell me that this guy's just... I don't know if he's actually supposed to be, like, a high school student, but, like, you know, just a dude.
He's supposed to be a high school student, yeah.
Yeah, just a dude in his long white trench coat for some reason, who apparently carries a knife on him so he can stab zombies.
Well, he wasn't expecting to stab zombies. We don't know who or what Soma Cruz was expected to stab, Caitlin. Let's be fair.
Yes.
But he ends up using it to stab zombies until he finds one of any number of other cool weapons. So one thing I'd just like to flag, because I've talked about this in the context of other Metroidvania-type games, I talked about this in the context of Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, and that is the issue of the map and backtracking, which is pretty much the bread and butter of a lot of these games where you acquire a new map. Now you have the double jump. Now you have the jump slide, etc., etc. And I find that in Area of Sorrow, the backtracking and the quality of the map is not as good as I'd like, but it's better than it could have been. And I was curious what your thoughts were on this topic.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't played a ton of games like this where you need to be, you know, looking at the map to try to find all those places that you can now hopefully get to. But at least for the period of time that I played, it was sufficient. I was able to be like, okay, I clearly haven't explored that area yet. I might be able to now. I will go back to it.
Yeah, for what it's worth, for those of you that are familiar with Castlevania Symphony of the Night, which is widely regarded, I think accurately, as the best Castlevania game, and also widely regarded as one of the best Metroidvanias period ever, and I'm also inclined to agree, for the PlayStation, it has mostly the same map system, which is to say it's a series of grids. It's basically a grid system, and it's just very good at identifying an area that is next to a place that you've been but haven't been to yet.
Yes.
And so when you acquire the double jump, you may or may not remember the specific details, but you can easily visually scan the map and say, well, here's three or four places where I might want to go check next to see if I can now get to the other side. Would I like to be able to annotate the map? Yes. But its absence isn't a deal breaker. And as I say, it's visually delightful enough that in Aria of Sorrow, I'm usually willing to haul myself to the next area of the map. Especially since by now, I might be so overleveled that the things there might not be any risk to me.
Yes, that part is very nice.
So are you inclined to try other Castlevania games, Caitlin? Was this a successful introduction?
Yeah. I mean, I've always enjoyed... Okay, I haven't played... Like, as you know, I haven't played any Castlevania games before Aria of Sorrow, and I've played a selection of Metroid games, mostly the GBA ones, because they were all really good. But I've always enjoyed those types of games, so I would be very happy to visit another Castlevania game. Maybe Symphony of the Night, because I'm curious to try what everybody says is the best one.
It's really good. The plot isn't substantially better. It has a number of, quite frankly, risible bits of writing.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very visually impressive, and there's tons of really interesting movement mechanisms that get introduced, and it's just really well done.
Is Symphony of the Night also pixel art?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting for a PlayStation game.
It was one of the early pixel art games that the developer and the publisher really pushed to get Sony's approval. Mm-hmm. And then when it was published and received with raptures, the story is, I don't know if this is true, but the story is that Sony somewhat relaxed its stance on pixel-only games.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, I would love to play it. Maybe in a future episode we can revisit it. Or you can revisit it and I will first visit it.
And maybe I should be more aggressive about playing some of those Game Boy Advance Metroid games. So that was Castlevania Aria of Sorrow. Now we take a break for some ads.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Buffalo Chicken Sub has arrived at Penn Station East Coast Subs. It's got the kick, it's got the crunch, and it's packed with bold buffalo flavor, melty cheese, and perfectly grilled chicken. Only for a limited time. Name a better pair than buffalo and chicken. Fresh cut fries and freshly squeezed lemonade? How about all of the above? Order the new Buffalo Chicken Sub any way you like it at your nearest Penn Station location today. Order ahead online at penn-station.com for easy pickup, or enjoy it hot off the grill for dine-in at Penn Station East Coast Subs.
And we're back with our feature game. Dragon's Dogma is an action RPG released by Capcom last year in 2024. It is a sequel to the first Dragon's Dogma, which was released a full 12 years before. It is somewhat unusual in game development for there to be this considerable a gap between installments. But then again, I previously talked about Virtua Fighter, so I guess I'm not in a position to comment. So, Caitlin, did you have any experience with the first Dragon's Dogma?
Yes. So I played the first Dragon's Dogma probably around 2012, 2013, pretty close to when it came out. I have no recollection of how I heard about it, but I was instantly enthralled because I could climb up enemies just like in Shadow of the Colossus, and I could hit them. And granted, I don't believe any of the enemies were nearly the same scale as the Colossi in Shadow of the Colossus, but it kind of still filled that little Shadow of the Colossus sized or shaped hole in my heart. So
you had a colossal hole in your heart. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a lot of fun with it. I really enjoyed, you know, going out there and just fighting big enemies. Also, I guess it brings to mind some of The Witcher 3, because it's, you know, kind of similar enemy types. The combat is not particularly similar.
Does it remind you of The Witcher because the protagonist is the lone actual human person and you're surrounded with a whole bunch of people that are not people but are being treated as objects?
Yeah, the pawns are a thing.
I'm going to have Witcher fans so angry at me. Still mean to play Witcher 3. Still mean to get to it.
Yeah. You should one of these days. It's quite good.
I absolutely mean to. So, okay, so what we're talking around is the pawn system. So the pawns feature very saliently both in the gameplay and in the plot of both Dragon's Dogma game. There's this notion of being the Arisen, which is more or less the Chosen One. Also apparently the head of government for some people.
Yes.
Which is an odd way to run a country, but we'll set that aside.
Yeah.
And they are able to command the Pawn Legion. The Pawn Legion is a bunch of, let's say, people, but we'll get back to that, that sometimes are just wandering around and sometimes are chilling out in some weird limbo space and will follow the orders of the Arisen without question. And here's the kicker. We are told that they are rational, but that they have no free will. That they have no volition of their own. They can think, they can speak, they have skills, they have knowledge, they have memory, but they don't want to do anything. They're just ready to be ordered around.
Yeah, I mean, that's everything. Like, that's what I've generally heard about pawns. But then I feel that the pawns that I actually interact with in game don't necessarily vibe with that. Because, I mean, I hired a friend's pawn to accompany me, which was wonderful because that friend's pawn was level 30 and I was not. And she was just able to, you know, wave her staff and stuff died. It was great. But, I mean, she would say, hey, I know you want to go do this quest. I know the way there. Follow me. Like, volunteer that kind of stuff. And that feels at least like a little bit.
I guess.
So, yeah.
They lean into this idea vastly less in Dragon's Dogma 2 than I remember them leaning into it in the first Dragon's Dogma. Which is good, because the vision that they present in the first Dragon's Dogma is both metaphysically and psychologically incoherent. I don't think it is plausible or possible for an entity to have full human rationality and not to have any volition.
Yeah,
I have a variety of secular philosophical commitments that make that basically impossible as far as I'm concerned. Like, I just don't understand how that could be true. And they do seem to exercise more initiative in Dragon's Dogma 2. But broadly speaking, they're mostly still there to take orders, which is fine. Like, I kept one of the things that is very striking is if you compare the structure of Dragon's Dogma to any other RPG we've played even this year. So Metaphor Refantasio, Veilguard, right? Those people are going to do whatever you tell them to do.
Yeah.
But yes. You don't need to tell a story about how they're somehow deficient in their will in order to get there. So I'm glad. Basically, this is me circling back to saying that I'm glad that they're leaning less into that Dragon's Dogma 2. It kind of fades into the background. Because, honestly, this whole idea that, yeah, they may look like they're rational, they may sound like they're rational, they can walk and talk and do things, but it's okay to order them around. I'm like, I'm sorry, that has very awkward historical overtones. Because that is literally the defense that a lot of people did, that a lot of people had for chattel slavery. No, I'm not joking. It's exactly the same.
Yep.
Word for word. And so, as I say, I'm glad they've kind of moved away from that. And now the pawn army, they lean less on the psychology of the pawn army and more just that they're these individuals that are there ready to do the bidding of the chosen one when and if that person shows up. It's like, okay, fine. That's a little more standard fantasy fare and less deeply weird than the way it was presented in the first Dragon's Dogma game. That was my impression anyway.
Yeah, that's a funny thing that you bring up just because I was immediately reminded of how the pawns are talking about the you know, these rumors that they've heard of this terrible disease that can affect pawns, and it makes them not listen to you. And, I mean, it does other things, too. But, I mean, so some of those, like, I never ran into one of these diseased pawns, but I have been instructed by friends who have already played Dragon's Dogma 2 that if I come across a pawn with red eyes, that I should either eject them from my group or kill them.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the pawns here, because so it's a relatively standard action RPG in a lot of ways, and you have these pawns and they act more or less like party members do. You can issue them simple commands, you can give them very weak AI parameters, then they'll try to follow that. They have an additional AI parameter in some kind of personality that has either been given to them by the person who rolled them up, or by there are some like ones that just come prefab in the world. How did you feel about wandering around with them, having your party, just their contribution to your experience of playing Dragon's Dogma 2? What was your sense of playing with pawns?
Good. I mean, they go around, they'll collect stuff for me. I guess there was some cool stuff that I didn't have the chance to fully see play out in front of me, but the pawns can retain some of the experiences that they've had with other people. So if you hire a pawn that has done a quest before, they will show you where to go. If you hire a pawn that has a lot of experience with a certain enemy type, they will tell you how, they will like recommend basically how to approach this enemy and defeating this enemy. So I think that is kind of neat. It's like they can become, you know, a buddy that's played this game before and can give you some tips while being an NPC.
Okay. I have serious questions about the quality of people that you're hanging out with. Myself included, I guess. I found them insufferable. Yeah, helpful, sure.
Sure.
Nice to have some more bodies on the battlefield, absolutely. Although even then, I've got some... They just wouldn't shut up.
They are chatty.
They talk all the time to each other, to you, to themselves. The same lines of dialogue. I heard someone tell me that, not all chests contain treasure at least half a dozen times.
Are you saying that pawns should be seen and not heard?
Oh, don't you dare put words in my mouth, Caitlin. What I'm saying is that when playing Dragon's Dogma, it made me wish for, like, my least favorite cast member from any other RPG I've played over the course of the past 12 months. Like, they are simultaneously absent of personality and yet aggressively grating. The part of this is the quality of the writing, which I think is bad, and the quality of the voice acting, which I also think is bad. You're given, when you're making your own pawn, you have a selection of a certain number of voices, and I went through all of them, and I found all of them obnoxious. And I thought, oh, this is a bad omen. And sure enough, every pawn I encounter, every NPC... Okay, let me back up a bit. I hate almost everything about Dragon's Dogma 2. I loathe Dragon's Dogma 2. It is the least favorite game that I played in recent memory. Okay. And part of it is the endless pawn jabber and the fake old-timey writing and dialogue delivery that would make me demand my money back at a medieval times. It's so bad. I am sick to death of generic medieval fantasy ersatz cosplay. Like, prithee and hence and aught can be done, master. Shall we go to the checkpointy? It's terrible.
Okay, so I played with Japanese voices.
Oh my goodness. Yes, that would make it better.
That's probably why I wasn't annoyed by them at all. Like, yeah, they talk a lot, but I don't have to read all the subtitles if they're just blabbing. So I don't know. It was just like, I think it made it easier to bear.
I completely forgot you could change the voice to Japanese. Oh, that's totally something I should have done. Now I feel stupid.
You don't need to feel stupid. Just, you can't always trust the English voice.
I'm just saying, so much theater kid energy going on here. It was just peak theater kid, like bad Ren Faire.
Oh, I'm deeply sorry.
On top of that, this I guess will lead me into questions I have about the combat system. Did you enjoy the combat?
It was fine. I still don't feel that I've really figured out how to do it. Like, I haven't been able to reliably block attacks yet. I'm playing a warrior. Or not a warrior. What do they call it? Maybe it's a warrior. I don't know. Sword and shield is my class. I don't know. I haven't been able to reliably do my kind of shield parry thing where I'm supposed to be able to block right before an attack. Just because I go to block and then I get hit before I get to raise the shield up. So there's a timing issue there that I haven't yet sorted out. And using abilities is fine, but I have to admit, I really enjoyed having my friend's level 30 pawn around to just blast things from the heavens. That was very convenient.
I, too, am having a hard time getting my abilities to trigger the way they're supposed to trigger. So I'm playing a thief, and the strong attack of the thief is supposed to be if you hit them from behind or if you hit an enemy who's off balance, you're supposed to do something special.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really have a good sense of when that is triggered or when it has been triggered. Part of that is just the visual noise of the system. Part of it is I don't really understand the logic of how that ability works.
Yeah.
A lot of other abilities that I acquire, some of them are neat. I'll confess that some of them I thought were really cool. There's this dashing attack that you can chain together. So it actually looks an awful lot like I'm like some character from a shonen anime, because you're just zipping back and forth at various directions, forming this weird tetrahedron of lines of deadliness around various enemies. It's really cool. It's fun. And then my stamina wears off, and then I slink off and catch my breath, and then I do it again.
Yeah. Oh, the stamina. The stamina system is not my favorite. But anyway.
Yeah, so the stamina system dovetails with climbing all over big monsters, which I'll get to in a second. But just generally, my impression from the combat of Dragon's Dogma 2, it's functional, but there's a lot of visual noise and chaos that's going on. I made the mistake, the first pawn that I hired, because the pawn that I made was Sword and Shield. I figured, okay, if I'm going to be fragile, I want someone to be attracting attention. And now I just wish she would shut up. And the first pawn that I hired was somebody's random magic user, because I figured, okay, well, they'll heal me at times, and so there we go. I've got a party to go do things. So the magic user likes casting flame magic, which is great, except for the fact that here I am tussling with a goblin or slashing away at a cyclops's shins, and then suddenly this stream of flamethrower fire comes from behind me and envelops both of us. And every time it happens, I panic and dodge roll like crazy to get out of there, even though it doesn't do any damage to me, but I can't see anything anymore. And meanwhile, my lizard brain is screaming to me, your digital avatar is on fire. I go into detail about this because I think it's an object lesson. It's representative of the general visual noise and chaos that accompanies what's going on in Dragon's Dogma 2. So to have all these, you can think, based on the talent descriptions and based on the tutorial notes, that you can craft some kind of build and have this ability trigger off into this other thing, and then da-da-da. No. It's just, for me at least, within the X hours that I played Dragon's Dogma 2, I wasn't past the, there's a lot happening here, stage.
So I had very much the same experience. Going back to my friend's level 30 pawn that I hired, I would be just fighting something, and then all of a sudden, lightning just envelops both of us and lands, and I'm like, oh my god! And it took a while to realize, oh, there's no friendly fire. Okay, I'm fine. But yeah, there's definitely this moment of panic that takes over first.
I encountered this goblin that was chucking the fantasy equivalent of Molotov cocktails at me.
Yes.
And I had the same response, and then I was just deeply confused. I couldn't tell whether fire was my friend or my enemy.
Oh, that's a good point, especially because you can't see everything around you at all times, so you don't know if that fire is, you know, a friend or a foe.
For all the chattering they do, at no point does any of the pawns say something helpful, like, "Master, fire in the hole." I genuinely would have appreciated that. That would have been great.
Yeah.
So, on that topic, the colossus-sized hole in your heart.
Yes.
How is climbing over big things for you?
So, I've only so far fought a handful of large enemies. Two of them were, like, those big ogre troll dudes. And
Cyclops.
Cyclops. Okay, I did not feel inclined to climb them because they were carrying a big club and I got scared. I did climb up the Medusa kind of character in the very beginning. And that was like, oh yeah, I remember doing this in Dragon's Dogma 1. But I don't feel that I've yet had the chance to explore the combat the way I want to. And that actually brings me to the worst thing about Dragon's Dogma 2 for me. Is the first night I played, I was totally fine. The second night I played, I got major motion sickness.
Oh, really?
Which is really unusual, because this is only, I think, the third-person game that I can think of that's ever given me motion sickness. The first two were the Dreamcast Echo the Dolphin and PlayStation Spyro the Dragon. Both of those messed me up as well.
Interesting.
So, I mean, I felt so sick, I ended up going to bed at, like, 9:30 or something, because I couldn't do anything else without feeling like I was gonna hurl.
Oh yeah, 9:30 is a totally unreasonable bedtime. I'm not an old man at all.
I'm a go to bed around midnight person usually.
It's true.
Yeah, so that was rough. I did, when I realized I was starting to feel sick, I changed a bunch of settings. Of course, once the motion sickness gets started, it does not stop. So I continued to feel terrible until I finally stopped playing the game. The next time I did decide to play, it was better. So I don't know. That second session that I played was definitely the longest. So I'm not sure yet if my motion sickness is cured. But if you do sometimes have motion sickness issues and you're interested in playing Dragon's Dogma, I would try to be careful. Make sure to adjust the settings. There's no FOV slider. But you can move the camera further away from the character, which is what I did, and that helped a lot. And apparently there's mods that you can use that will allow for an FOV slider. I haven't tried that yet. If I try again and get sick again, I will definitely be downloading the mod and see what that can do for me.
So circling back to climbing large enemies and the stamina system.
Yes.
I was like, all right, maybe Dragon's Dogma isn't at its best when you're messing around with goblins and other humans and whatever. Okay, fine. Let's go and try to climb all over some cyclopes because this is supposed to be, you know, the hook of Dragon's Dogma. So I'll just lay it out from start to finish, albeit briefly. So I'd had my first pawn acquire a warrior skill that lets her use her shield to vaunt you up in the air.
Okay.
And you're, okay, that's kind of cool. So she says, Master, come do this thing. And I'm like, fine. And I run in and she sends me vaulting about 20 feet wide of a Cyclops. Okay, fine. So I land in a humiliating fashion, heal up from the fall damage that I just took. I'm like, all right, let's try this again. So I'm climbing up the Cyclops.
Yeah.
And I start stabbing its back.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I'm not doing considerably more damage from here than I would be just slashing away at its shins. And oh, wait, my stamina is being reduced. Oh, so then I fall off the Cyclops.
Yes.
And I land flat on my face, and your character seems to be prone for a realistic, albeit frustrating, quantity of time. Cyclops sits on my face. I die. Okay, let's try that again.
This
time I make a beeline for the Cyclops, climb up to its back, wait until I've got half my stamina left. Okay, I'll be safe here. And then I specifically use a different talent that I'd acquired that says better used from high distances. Because what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to jump off and you start spinning like crazy, stabbing like mad. I do that. This has zero visible effect. But now I'm on the ground. Okay, fine. And then I'm like, all right, let's see what happens if I slash it at shins. Surely it does less damage. No, it did more damage in that case. I don't know why. Before I was stabbing its spine, I think, okay, attempt number three.
Yeah.
I try climbing up to its head. Maybe I can just stab it right in the head. Maybe that'll do more. But for whatever reason, the moment I get past its shoulders, I'm then not able to attack anymore, and it engages either in a series of animations where I'm like hanging on for dear life, regardless of what the Cyclops is doing,
okay,
or It was so bizarre. I just wasn't able to attack. Run out of stamina, fall to the ground, humiliating, it's embarrassing, whatever.
Yeah.
And so consequently, when I've killed a number of cyclopes, I've killed a number of large things, I've just found the slash at their knees to be vastly more efficient and effective and less confusing. Now, I haven't fought anything considerably larger.
Yeah.
It could be the case that you end up with monsters where you have to basically climb to a vulnerable bit and then start poking them there. But frankly, it was one of those things where it's like, hey, here's this subsystem full of weird rules that are not immediately transparent or not well understood. Or you could just do things the efficient and straightforward way, which is never, to my mind, a very good sign.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah, I never tried to climb up the Cyclops guys.
But it's always the first thing you say when you talk about Dragon Saga. You have to climb over things.
I
wanted to hear your success about climbing over guys.
Let me rephrase that.
I wanted to hear about your success with scaling monsters.
Yes. Yeah, I sadly did not do too much of that in the last few days when I've been playing. So, whoops.
Why did I buy this full price game, Caitlin? Where these maybe slaves, maybe not slaves anymore, maybe they got better, chatter at me endlessly about the twigs that they're finding, if you weren't going to climb over some monsters for me?
I don't know. I have so far, other than the motion sickness incident, have been having a good time and will continue playing, and I will surely tell you when I do scale a monster creature and stab it, maybe not in the head, because apparently you might not be allowed to stab things in the head.
I'm perfectly willing to believe that it was something I was doing wrong. It's just, again, the game isn't very transparent. It's not very good at explaining how to do things. There's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, Dragon's Dogma 2 is a huge world full of, I'll say, things to do. I didn't find any of them interesting. Mostly you wander around and kill things like that. But then again, you can pare down almost any RPG into that. Like, if you wanted to boil down Dragon Age 2 into wandering around and killing things, you could probably do that, although less wandering around.
Yeah, Dragon's Dogma is a lot of wandering around, especially because there's not... I mean, there's you can take, like, these ox carts around, so that kind of helps.
There's a small number of fast travel points.
Yeah, and there's a... You can either buy a fairy stone, which is quite expensive, or you will find them lying around. And fairy stones just let you teleport to a, you know, one of those portal stone things that are generally situated near or at cities.
And if you dig what Dragon's Dogma 2 is putting down, there's a ton of content there.
Absolutely. So much, yeah.
It is a huge, dull, ugly world for you to explore. Which is the last thing I will say about Dragon's Dogma 2. I find it hideously ugly. The graphics engine is the Resident Evil engine. I've seen it do other things. But as far as generic woodland and generic medieval castle and generic medieval people go, I find it all very, very visually displeasing.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I will definitely say that the style is rather generic and the colors are maybe a little dull. So, yeah, from a visual standpoint, like, I still think that there are some cool-looking areas, but yeah, the cities have no, they don't have any personality. It's just a bunch of houses to huts. Sometimes there's stone stuff. I don't know. Yeah, it's very generic fantasy. So you really need to have some other thing about it that you enjoy. And for me, I do enjoy the combat. I theoretically will enjoy scaling large enemies and stabbing them, but I haven't done too much of it yet. So
your description, honestly, to me, sounds like the same remit and degree of enthusiasm that the designers had in Dragon's Dogma 2.
Oh, no.
Houses, maybe some huts, some sewn stuff.
Yeah.
I could see it on their storyboards right now. Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it, Caitlin. I hope that you continue to get enjoyment out of it. I found it painful, and I am never going back.
Understandable.
But I was curious. I will genuinely say they did a much better job handling the pawns than they did in the first Dragon's Dogma. So, kudos to that. They at least knew that they had some work to do.
Yeah, I mean, I did have a lot of fun with the character creator. I will say that you can customize the gait of your character.
Yeah.
And my character looked pretty normal in the character creator. But then I sprinted for the first time, and I looked like a godforsaken clown. So
I felt the same way about the coloration. Like, I thought I had the skin tone down the way I wanted. I thought the hair color looked reasonable. And get the main character in some natural-looking look, and you look like a clown. It's yeah, a lot of character creators do that, and Dragon's Dogma is no exception.
Yeah, like, I thought everyone would learn after Dragon Age Inquisition's ugly, green, lightless character creator. Like, no, we should give some options. Let you see your character in different lights and blah, blah. No. No. We don't do that.
All right, so that's Dragon's Dogma 2. We are now going to proceed to some shameless hyping of upcoming titles, but Caitlin, you have abandoned enthusiasm and optimism for the future. That is correct?
All right. It is.
Well, I'm going to point out that in a scant number of days, February the 18th, we are going to have Avowed. Avowed is a game by Obsidian. Obsidian is a company that has done a lot of good stuff in the past. You, in particular, Caitlin, have shouted out The Outer Worlds 2, which Obsidian is working on.
Mm-hmm.
But this is going to be yet another action RPG that is going to be released on Game Pass. And I am very curious to see what they're doing, because there's not a whole lot of original IPs running around. Sometimes that works out well, sometimes it doesn't. But I'm curious to see what Avowed is going to look like.
Yeah, I've been really curious about that one too, actually. It's, and the art in the advertisements looks cool, but I don't know anything about it. So
highly competent marketing so far, yes.
Yes.
And that's why we put the shameless in shout. So thank you so much for joining us, dear listeners. It's been a pleasure to have you. Thank you for spending the time. We hope to see you again soon, and we hope that you are enjoying whatever it is that you're doing, whether it's video games or otherwise. Please do take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Buffalo Chicken Sub has arrived at Penn Station East Coast Subs. It's got the kick, it's got the crunch, and it's packed with bold buffalo flavor, melty cheese, and perfectly grilled chicken. Only for a limited time. Name a better pair than buffalo and chicken. Fresh cut fries and freshly squeezed lemonade? How about all of the above? Order the new Buffalo Chicken Sub any way you like it at your nearest Penn Station location today. Order ahead online at penn-station.com for easy pickup. Or enjoy it hot off the grill for dine-in at Penn Station East Coast Subs.